The Big Journey from Creation to New Creation. This is a Bible teaching series that will take you all the way through the Bible, from the creation account in Genesis to John's vision of the new creation in the book of Revelation. This series is brought to you by creationtonewcreation.com. In our last talk, we saw how God married his people Israel at Mount Sinai. Exodus chapters 20 to 23 are their marriage vows. These vows were supplemented and expanded by various other passages in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Collectively, we call these passages the Law. The Hebrew word for law is Torah, meaning instruction or guidance. As well as giving them moral and social laws, God gave his people the blueprint for the tabernacle and its furnishings. He instructed them about the sacrifices they were to offer and about the priests and Levites. He explained how his people should keep themselves pure. He laid out the calendar of holy days and festivals and prescribed the tithes and the offerings of first fruits. And he spelled out how their king should rule in preparation for the day when a king would rule over them. Jesus summed up the law by quoting from Deuteronomy 6 verse 5 and Leviticus 19 verse 18. He said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." Why did God give his people the law? Firstly, through the law, God reveals himself. The law displays his righteousness and holiness. It reveals his goodness, his love, his grace, and his mercy. Secondly, God gave the law to reveal sin. The law showed his people and shows us today what sin really is. Thirdly, God gave the law to curb sin among his people. Sin is like an acid that corrodes and destroys. God loved his people Israel, and he didn't want sin to overwhelm and destroy them. So the law wasn't, in Elmer Martin's words, a set of arbitrary restrictions intended to inhibit people and make them feel miserable and guilty. It was to enable his people to enjoy a truly satisfying life. If his people obeyed his law, tremendous blessing would overtake them. Fourthly, the law taught Israel about holiness. God instructed Aaron, "You are to distinguish between the holy and the common, and between the unclean and the clean." Remember how Mount Sinai quaked and smoked and burnt as God descended on it. Now he lived in the very midst of them. In his commentary on Leviticus, J. Sklar imagines an Israelite asking this burning question: "How in the world can the holy and pure King of the universe dwell among his sinful and impure people? How can he live here in our very midst without his holiness melting us in our sin and impurity?" So God instructed his people how to keep the tabernacle, their camp, and later the promised land, and themselves, in a state fit for him to live among them. Finally, the law prepared God's people for Jesus' coming. When Jesus came, he didn't have to teach people how sin needed to be atoned for. God had been teaching them that for centuries through the law and the sacrifices. To our modern eyes, the Old Testament sacrifices seem complicated and obscure. We enter a gory world of blood and butchery and burning carcasses that may even seem repugnant to us. But through the sacrificial system, the repentant sinner could be cleansed of sin, cleared of sin's debt, forgiven, rededicated to God, and reconciled to him. All this is summarized in one word: atonement. There were five basic types of sacrifice. Firstly, the sin offering, also called the purification offering, dealt with the moral pollution of sin. It also dealt with some ritual impurities too, which were not the result of sin. The focus of the sin offering was on what was done with the animal's blood. Blood represents life, and when blood is shed, it represents life being poured out and extinguished. The blood of a sacrificial animal represented its death, and its death provided cleansing from the pollution of sin. Sin is a moral defilement. Our holy God cannot live in the presence of sin. And so sin separates people from God, and that separation from God is death. As we said in an earlier talk, death is far more than physical death. Fundamentally, death is relational death. Death is a set of broken relationships. First and foremost, it is a broken relationship with God. So the penalty of sin is death. That's the penalty that the person making the sin offering should have suffered. But God in his grace accepted the death of the animal instead. Secondly, sometimes sin requires things to be put right. Restitution is required. This was the emphasis of the restitution offering, also called the guilt offering or trespass offering. Thirdly, a person dedicated himself wholly to God through the whole burnt offering. And fourthly, through the grain offering, he gave God a token of his daily work and all that he had gained through his work, such as his crops. Finally, there was a fellowship offering. This was also called the peace offering. This was unique in that the sacrificial animal was eaten by the person offering the sacrifice. Others would have been invited to share the meal too. Eating this meal affirmed and celebrated the fellowship between God and the one who offered the sacrifice and those who shared the sacrificial meal with him. It also affirmed the fellowship between everyone who shared the meal too. These five basic kinds of sacrifice picture how a sinner could be reconciled with God. Firstly, there needed to be cleansing from the moral pollution of sin. That was achieved through the sin offering. Secondly, things might have to be put right, for example, by making restitution. That was achieved through the restitution offering. Now the person is cleansed from sin, and things have been put right where that was necessary. Now he could rededicate himself and his daily work and the fruits of his labours to God. He did this through the whole burnt offering and the grain offering, respectively. And so, after these four sacrifices, his relationship with God was fully restored. Now the person could celebrate fellowship with God and his fellow Israelites too, through the fellowship offering. Burnt offerings, accompanied by grain and drink offerings, were also offered for the whole nation each day, each Sabbath, and accompanied by a sin offering on the first day of each month. These daily burnt offerings symbolized the perpetual consecration of the whole nation to God. There were also two very special sacrifices that took place once a year. These were the Passover and the sacrifice of two goats on the Day of Atonement. At the Feast of Passover, each Israelite family would slay a lamb or goat and eat it as part of a meal. It celebrated their deliverance from Egypt, and it affirmed their covenant relationship with God. Then followed the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when people didn't eat anything made with leaven. What was the significance of this feast? In ancient times, people typically used to take a piece of leavened dough from one batch of bread in order to leaven the next batch. But if a piece of leaven went bad, it would contaminate the batch it was used in. Leaven taken from this contaminated batch would, in turn, contaminate the following batch, and so on. So to break this chain of contamination, people had to start afresh with a new piece of naturally leavened dough. This is what they did at the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Before this feast began, the Israelites would get rid of all their old leaven. It was a decontamination process. It symbolized putting away sin. It symbolized a new start. Then, for 7 days, they would eat only unleavened bread. The Day of Atonement occurred annually, in the 7th month. During the previous year, there were certain to have been many sins committed which had not been properly atoned for. And some sins couldn't be atoned for by the regular sacrifices anyway. What could be done? God's answer was the Day of Atonement. On this great day, a special sin offering was made for all the sins of a nation over the preceding year. This offering comprised a pair of goats. The first goat was killed. The high priest brought its blood, together with that of a bull offered for himself, right into the most holy place. Blood was also sprinkled in the holy place and on the altar of burnt offering. Then the high priest placed both hands on the head of the other goat. This goat was called the scapegoat. He confessed all the iniquities of the people of Israel and all their transgressions, all their sins. Notice how comprehensive this is. Iniquities, transgressions, sins. By doing this, he transferred the sins of the entire nation onto the goat. It was as if the goat was now considered to be responsible for all the nation's sins over the whole of the previous year. The goat was then led out eastward into the wilderness and released. It wasn't killed, it suffered something far worse. As we've already said, death is more than just physical death. Death is a set of broken relationships. First and foremost, it is a broken relationship with God. That's what this scapegoat symbolically endured. It was banished to the remote, uninhabited wilderness, far from God's presence. Symbolically, its relationship with God was broken forever. That was the penalty that the nation should have suffered. The scapegoat symbolically suffered this penalty in their place. The sacrifices on the Day of Atonement fully atoned for the nation's sins over the previous year. God could continue to live among his people. The sacrifices, of course, could never, of themselves, make atonement for sins. The writer to the Hebrews tells us, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. But Jesus, by his single sacrifice of himself on the cross, made full and perfect atonement for sin. In fact, his death fulfilled the whole sacrificial system, as we'll see in a later talk. God promised his people that if they were obedient, they, their livestock, and their land would be fruitful. The first fruits of this abundance was to be given back to God. The firstborn were to be consecrated to God. Soon after the Exodus, the tribe of Levi was given to God and served him instead of the firstborn. The firstborn males of the livestock were to be given to God too, as was the firstfruits of the agricultural produce. In addition, there were two national firstfruits offerings, the first ripe sheaf during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and two loaves at Pentecost. The law also specified that the produce of the land was to be tithed. The tithe was a 10% portion of the crops, herds, and flocks. Taking the different passages together, we see that the bulk of the tithes went to the Levites. The priests also received a portion. On some years, the tithes were shared with the immigrants, the fatherless, and the widows, those in the community who most needed support. God also set apart holy days and festivals. They're called the Feasts of the Lord. The Hebrew term translated feasts here really means appointed time or appointed season. The seventh day of each week was the Sabbath. God's people were to do no work on this day. It was a day of solemn rest, a holy gathering. In addition to the Sabbath, the law specified seven additional feasts. Four of these were in the spring. The first was the Passover. This was followed by the week-long Feast of Unleavened Bread. During this feast, too, the people offered the first fruits of their cereal harvest. 50 days after the first fruits was the Feast of Pentecost. Three further feasts followed in the autumn. The Feast of Trumpets took place on the first day of the seventh month. 10 days later was the Great Day of Atonement. 5 days after this was the crowning feast of the year, the joyful Feast of Tabernacles. This was also called the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Ingathering. Why did God institute these feasts? Firstly, they celebrated Israel's national history. The Feast of Passover recalled the first Passover and the Exodus from Egypt. At Pentecost, God's people were to remember that they were once slaves in Egypt. And during the Feast of Tabernacles, people were to live in temporary shelters, recalling their wilderness wanderings. Secondly, they celebrated God's blessings to them in the present. God promised his people that if they were obedient, he would make the promised land fruitful. three of the feasts celebrate this fruitfulness. At the Feast of First Fruits, the first fruits of a barley harvest were offered to God. The Feast of Pentecost was also called the Feast of Harvest or the Day of the First Fruits. On this day, the first fruits of a wheat harvest were offered in the form of two loaves. The Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, also called the Feast of Ingathering, occurred at the end of the fruit harvest, when all the crops had been safely gathered in. So the feasts looked back to the past, and they celebrated the present. And finally, the feasts also looked forward to what God was going to do in the future through the Messiah. The Messiah, Jesus Christ, fulfilled the Feast of Passover. He was our Passover Lamb, as we shall see in a later talk. At the Feast of Unleavened Bread, God's people removed the old leaven, thus breaking the chain of contamination from one batch of bread to another. By his death, Jesus broke the chain of contamination with sin that began with our forefather Adam. During the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the first fruits of a cereal harvest were offered. Jesus fulfilled this offering too. He rose on the very day of the first fruits offering. He is the first fruits, the first to rise from the dead. And 50 days after his resurrection, Jesus fulfilled the Feast of Pentecost. On that momentous day, God poured out the Holy Spirit. God himself began to live in human hearts. On that day, a gospel harvest began that will continue until Jesus comes again. The Feast of Trumpets looks forward to the end of the age when the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God. When Jesus returns, he will judge the world and gather his people from every age and place to himself. The sacrifices of the Day of Atonement prefigured Jesus' atoning sacrifice on the cross. As our great high priest, he entered the most holy place with his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption for us. And Jesus is our scapegoat. God laid on him the sin of the world, and he bore the penalty for sin, separation from God, for us. And when Jesus comes again, all that he accomplished on the cross will come into full and final effect. Satan and sin will never trouble God's creation again. Finally, the Feast of Tabernacles points forward to the end of the age. Then God's gospel harvest will be fully gathered in. His people will enjoy perfect rest and joy on the new earth. So God's plan of redemption through the Messiah was foreshadowed way back in Old Testament times through these feasts that God ordained for his people Israel. How awesome is that? Finally, in addition to the Sabbath day, there was a Sabbath year and another special year called the Year of Jubilee. On the Sabbath year, the land wasn't ploughed or sown. People did no agricultural work. They simply ate what the land yielded naturally. During this year, debts were cancelled too. Each 50th year was the Year of Jubilee. It was a Sabbath year when no agricultural work was to be done. In addition, Hebrews who were servants to other Hebrews were released. Land or property that was sold off was returned to its original owners. For those forced to sell their land or themselves through poverty, the slate was wiped clean. The fall brought toil. But during the Sabbath days and years and the years of Jubilee, God released his people from toil. On the Sabbath and Jubilee years, the curse on the ground was lifted too. The land yielded its produce naturally, without effort. The Jubilee brought even greater blessing. Servants were released. People who had been obliged to sell their property could go home and reclaim it. It was a new time of liberty, joy, and blessing. Through the Sabbath days and years and the years of Jubilee, God was giving his people a foretaste of the world to come, when the effects of the fall would be no more. He was giving them a taste of what life would be like on the new earth. In our next talk, we'll trace the history of God's people from Sinai through the wilderness and on into the Promised Land.